What's up, America? I'm Chad the Bird, and this is my podcast. Hey, Chicago, I'm talking to you specifically. You're living under a climate crisis, amongst other things. The city council voted to officially declare that you are experiencing a climate emergency. This last year, you saw 20-foot waves from Lake Michigan flood parts of the city and disappear whole parts of your beaches. So, unless you want to stand on the shoreline and calmly accept it like Taya Leone at the end of Deep Impact, the time is now to do something about climate change. Join Hero Power right now, and you can have 100% of your electricity consumption matched with Green E-certified renewable energy certificates and still pay the ComEd basic electric rate. That's right. I didn't stutter. You heard me. You support clean energy every time you pay your electricity bill, and it's no extra cost to you. It's easy. Takes 2 minutes. You can do it right now in self-isolation at myheropower.com. And if you think all this shit is just a little too weird, why don't you do a shot of Malort? If you're feeling absurd, getting advice from a bird, just do a shot of Malort. Malort, Hero Power, proud sponsors of Chad the Podcast, which is what you're listening to right now. What's going on? Oh, how are you feeling?
I hope you're feeling okay and that you're hydrating. I'm going to keep this real tight because we got a long episode ahead of us, so strap in. And it's going to get really technical, and it's going to get a little dark, but I felt like that was super important because the internet is full of crazy people right now being like, you know what I'm not going to wear a mask because of my freedoms and my guns. And the thing is, you just got to push back against that kind of noise. So this episode I interviewed, so do you guys remember like towards the beginning of the lockdown, like forever back when the COVID thing first started, and I interviewed that woman who was going to school right across the street from the CDC, that Jenna Zagorin. Turns out her uncle is a for reals like surgeon, doctor, guy who knows a lot of shit about everything, and that's Dr. Alan Zagorin. He's a D-O-M-P-A-F-A-C-O-S-F-A-C-N. There's so many little numbers and letters at the end of his name. It's fucking crazy. And we get into it, so don't worry. All of that's going to come clear. So I called him up on my vacation to ask him what the fuck is going on. What are we going to do? How are we all going to work out? And, like, the news is not the greatest, so it's going to get a little dark in there. But I promise you it's a shit ton of fun. So, like, don't get too nervous. I promise it's still a good time. But this is really important. I feel like you guys really need to listen to this one, especially nowadays. You in the future will probably listen to this and go, holy fuck, that was a lot of information. Jesus, like, we've already beaten the disease, and now we're on, you know, in space. We're, like, hanging out on the moon at a moon bar, and you're making me listen to this shit? Look, this isn't for you, future people. This is for present people. This is for 2020 people, the downtrodden and angry and Facebookly exhausted. So please put this in your ears and enjoy yourself because it's chock full of information that's totally medicinal. So let's go to that conversation with Dr. Alan Zagorin, already in progress.
I can't promise that you like me. It could go downhill. I can't promise that you love me, but you probably will.
You have a lot of letters and dots after your name. What's your official title?
Well, I have a number of official titles. You mean my professional license title, or?
Well, all right, humble brag, but yeah. What's your official your official professional title? Like, well, I address you as doctor, right?
That is true.
Like, you're not a sir or a esquire.
No, I am not.
Okay.
I am a doctor.
Awesome. Okay, second question. So you're a doctor, but you have a PhD, right?
No, I'm a medical doctor.
Okay. When you get a PhD, are you not also considered a doctor?
Yes, that's true.
Okay. So if you were to get a PhD, would you be a double doctor?
Technically, yes, but you would still be referred to as a doctor.
Well, like, you can't, whoa. So there's no other term, like, okay. Like, I wouldn't say, you wouldn't be doctor.
No.
Okay, you'd just be doctor. But you would have double the doctor. And then therefore you're like twice as powerful.
Well, you would have more study. So hopefully, depending upon how they complemented each other, you would have studied and obtained more in-depth knowledge.
You're twice as learned.
If you have another doctor, besides being a physician and a PhD, yes, but typically a PhD is a research degree, not necessarily a practical degree in caring for patients and dealing with disease.
I were to get a PhD in doctoring, would I then therefore have a doctorate in doctoring?
Theoretically, yes.
Fuck yes. There is hope for me yet. All right, so you are a doctor without a PhD, but like if you were to get a PhD, what would you get a PhD in?
Well, that's hard to say at this point in my life. I do have a master's degree in public administration, which is a social science degree as opposed to a medical science degree. And I probably at this point would advance that in an area in social science, such as ethics, which is one of my areas.
Oh, so you're really into ethics, as in like, hey, current administration, you need some learning in ethics.
That might be a good observation, yes.
okay, so let's talk more about the dots and letters after your name. So officially, I call you doctor, but there's a lot more going on. So you're Dr. Alan Zagorin, and then there's a bunch of letters and dots. What does that mean? What does all that mean?
Well, after my medical degree, which is a doctor of osteopathic medicine.
That's the DO part?
That is the DO part, yes. Then there's a master of public administration, which is the MPA part, which, as I mentioned earlier, is a social science degree. Then there's the FACOS part, because I am a trauma general surgeon. And that just designates that I'm a fellow of the College of Surgeons, which just means that I've accomplished certifications and things, and I've become, in that case, sort of a doctor's doctor, but not with two doctor degrees. And then there's the FACN, which is the Fellow of the American College of Nutrition, because I'm a certified interventional nutritionist who deals with critical care nutrition and people that have that are very sick, that can't eat by mouth. There's a few others, but they're not on my letterhead. I'm a fellow of the International College of Surgeons as well, which is an honorary degree. And then I'm also, well, that's enough. There's others. But
that's is there more? Are there any letters that were missing in the alphabet? Okay. So what would you say? So you have many areas of expertise. And this is not, again, this is not a brag. This is like you studied for this. How long would you say that you studied in school? Like, okay, so, you know, you go K through 12, and then you go college for 4 years, and then it's like work at a restaurant. But that's not what you did.
I did all that K through 12 stuff. Awesome. Then I got an undergraduate degree, which is another set of letters, which isn't there. And then I actually worked on a master's in education, which is another master's, which isn't there, which is two more years. And then 4 years of medical school, 6 years of learning surgery and critical care and all that, which is called a residency.
Wow.
So already we're talking about after high school, 4, 6, 12, then a master's in public administration, which was another 2 years. So that's 14 years after high school of actual study, classroom, and residency, so on, so on.
So this is important because you get a lot of armchair people on the Facebooks and Instagrams that are like, I read a thing, so I know a thing. And it's hard because then you it seems like they know a thing, but in fact, you do know a thing because you spent all that time studying the thing.
I think so. And then, of course, more than that, the practical knowledge from experience over the course of my medical and social science career, which now spans 40 years.
Damn. Okay. I'm just trying to think about what I did after high school, and it's making me sad. And I want to go back to school, but I also don't know if I have the stamina for it. So I'm going to continue being I'm just going to keep reading what I read. But I feel like the reason that this kind of stuff is important is because you get so many people that think that just because they read a thing and can cognitively understand a thing, that they are not necessarily an expert on a thing, but their opinion is important. And I'm like, I don't know if I agree with that, especially when it comes to medical science, because I feel like the people that I want to listen to are the people that have spent the last 40 years doing the thing, which is like Fauci is one of those guys, right?
Yes, Dr. Fauci, I think, is doing it a little longer than I am.
Damn. Okay. Where would you feel comfortable saying you're an expert?
Well, I'm an expert in general medical knowledge. I have an expertise in terms of human physiology, human critical illness, because that is what I studied.
Right.
Obviously, surgery, which is, you know, the craft of the technical aspect of operating on the human body, but there's a lot behind that and understanding the basic physiology of how our parts work and when they don't work, what do you do about it? And then, of course, on the other side of it, in the social science part of it, I also have a fair amount of knowledge in terms of the area of public administration, which is basically a social science that has to do with public policy and the relationship between public policy and how governments and organizations work, how they can be measured against what should be the normals, and of course the ethics and therefore the morality, which is one of the sort of finite areas that I teach and write in.
So we're kicking ass right now in all of those fields.
Not quite.
So there's a lot to unpack. Let's start here. Right now, we as a country are experiencing waves of a pandemic, right?
Well, I wouldn't say it's exactly waves. I think it's a wave. We're in the beginning of it. And that is something that Dr. Fauci and the experts have been trying to explain since February. At the beginning, there's a first wave of infectious and disease as a result of that. And then depending upon how the society will deal with it, or hopefully will deal with it, it will eventually wane out a little bit. And then as seasons change and as people move around from inside to outside, outside to inside, like winter to summer, then there tends to be another wave further down the line until at some point, in this case, the organism that's humans, either develops what's called a herd immunity, meaning eventually we all become somewhat immune, or the majority of us become immune, therefore the virus dies, or does it show its ugly head, or we develop a vaccine to develop that herd immunity, and then the virus really does not create the problem that it created in the first place. So we're in the first wave.
Right.
Unfortunately, we have not done the right things in many cases to stave that off. And so it's continuing.
So how are we, all right, so I'm gonna throw a medical question at you. It's very particular, very complicated. And I know it's a big thing, so we're just gonna break it down bit by bit. How are we fucking this up?
Well, there are many ways that's occurring. If I might explain a little bit about a novel virus, that will explain why there's a problem.
Right.
At the very beginning, probably somewhere in the beginning of the fall, maybe October, November, we don't know exactly the day, there was a virus in a animal. And typically humans and animal viruses, humans don't get infected with animal virus and vice versa, because the way in which a virus attacks a organism is through the DNA and RNA of the relationship between the virus's DNA and RNA and the host, meaning the animal, RNA and DNA. And if they don't match up, the virus can latch onto the cell of the host. So an animal virus, which this was, we think probably a bat virus, changed in some way and wound up being able to infect a human at the beginning. Now, we don't know if it went through another animal or it came right from the bat. Someday we'll probably learn that, but we don't know that now. And then that virus infected a human, but at the beginning when those things happen, and it's happened many times, the H1N1's one of them, SARS is another, HIV is another one. When those viruses happen, typically the only way you can get it is from the original animal. But if the virus mutates or changes its DNA or RNA structure and adapts to the new host, in this case, the human, that's us.
I'm cool on this side right now. Like, are birds affected by this? I'm very curious about that. No one's
giving... most likely not.
Boom. All right, go on.
So initially, this virus jumped to humans, but it could only be obtained from the original host, which was either a bat or something other than a bat. Like a bat may have bitten a pig, and pigs' DNA and RNA is similar to humans, so it may have jumped that way. We don't know. But then it changed, and it allowed for the ability of one human to infect another one. Well, the problem with that is that we have absolutely no genetic historical immunity to that virus because it's not normally in our environment. Typically, for example, with the flu, our historical ancestors were exposed to it. It didn't come from another animal. So that we have some immunity, so it affects different people different ways. It's one of the reasons why we have to get a different kind of flu shot every year, because it changes a little, but it's a human virus. So we have some natural immunity. That's why everybody doesn't get it. And that's why the flu, while a bad thing, a horrible thing, is not as aggressive as the COVID virus, because the COVID virus was never in humans. And so we have absolutely no natural ability to fight any of it off. Not only that, what's happened from the beginning in November or whenever it was, it has also changed and mutated. So we know now that there's at least two strains, and I would argue there's probably more than that, that are slightly different. So, and we know that one strain was the strain that evolved in Asia, and the other strain was the one that evolved in Europe, and they had different methodologies of getting into the U.S. and probably around the same time. We think later in December or early January, it was already here before the cases in Washington State showed up. Once it's in the human and we pass it from human to human, generally we don't have the ability to fight the virus off. So the only way you can prevent the virus from going from human to human is to find out who's got it, isolate them, not let them interact with other humans, test to see who's got it, because not everybody gets terrible sick. Some people wind up having it and don't realize they do, but yet they're infectious, and isolate them. And had we have done that early on, if we had done a very strict national isolate everybody like New Zealand did, and then identify who it was passed to, and then to isolate those people, you stop the transmission. Now, obviously, when you're dealing with a country of 300 million people or billions of people worldwide, that's a tall order and unlikely to happen. But at the beginning, if we had had a much more aggressive approach, like masks and like washing hands and social distancing, identifying who has it, finding out who they've been with to try to isolate it. Because right now, we have no drugs to kill the virus. We have no way to prevent it. We have no way to enhance immunity. We have some treatments that are, they're okay.
What are some of those treatments? Because I hear back and forth. There's like the hydroclimaclone and the Rifaman and the Rytojams and I believe also sunlight.
Okay, no, not sunlight. The hydrochloroquine actually doesn't do anything. It was originally purported in a study that came, I believe, out of Asia originally, that it might do some prevention. And there's some science behind why it might. Hydrochloroquine is actually used for malaria. It's actually in this country used for rheumatoid arthritis. And it does something to body cells that theoretically would in some way set up some barriers for a virus to enter the cell. But we know that it really doesn't do it with COVID-19. In fact, there was a study published just this week, which showed not only doesn't it work in the acute hospital setting, but it has absolutely no efficacy, or means it doesn't work in the outpatient setting, whether it be prevention or therapy. It just does not. And it does have some side effects. They're pretty severe. Some studies have showed increased cardiac problems with people that were on it. But in general, it just doesn't. It doesn't work, and it's not something that people should be putting sort of false hope on. We need to ignore that. Then there's a viral agent called remdesivir, which is an antiviral drug. Yeah.
Okay.
It's an antiviral agent, which actually attacks and breaks down the DNA of the virus. So it's kind of not an antibiotic, but it's an antiviral. Antibiotics work in a different way. They don't work on viruses. But this has some effect. But the problem with it is it's not a, oh, my gosh, this is a great eureka moment. It does help. The other thing is something called immune serum. So people that have had the virus, that we know have had it, we can measure the antibodies in their blood. And we can go ahead and extract that portion of their blood, the plasma, and give it to somebody who has the acute disease. And it does help, in some cases, reduce the severity of the disease. So those right now are the three therapies directed at the virus. Other than that, we also have dexamethasone and other steroids, which are anti-inflammatories, which help the effects of the virus. They don't do anything to the virus, but they reduce the body's overt reaction to the virus by reducing our ability to create massive inflammation, which is what the virus causes in some people. And it's that massive inflammation that makes people terrible sick.
So there's a thing that I don't think is getting enough attention on the news, because I think all we hear now is, should we wear a mask? Should we wear a mask? Who's in charge? Brr, 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 brr. But nobody ever stops and goes, hey, what does this thing actually fucking do to people? And I know, because we talked earlier, that you have been in contact with people that are experiencing the worst symptoms of the disease, correct?
Yes. I don't directly treat them. What I do is deal with some of the potential traumas that the disease creates in humans. And in my world, it's things that happen to the skin. And most of those are related to the therapy, not necessarily the virus. The virus creates, for example, patients that wind up in respiratory failure. So they're not oxygenating, which is primarily the big problem. There's lots of others now, but so they wind up having to be on huge amounts of oxygen through tubing that goes through their nose, or a ventilator which goes through their mouth. And these plastic tubings push against the skin of the body, and they can create pressure sores on the body because they have to be there all the time. So those are that's in my world, that's some of the things we deal with. But I can tell you that we just recently saw a patient that had a strange lesion on their skin, kind of a sore, not that we saw that with HIV, but similar. HIV can create something like this as well. And it was very unusual. This is a person that was recovering from COVID-19. And everybody was scratching their heads as to what this was. And we just recently biopsied it, and I don't have the results yet, but I'm fairly convinced that it had something to do with the inflammation reaction that the person had to the disease. The question becomes, is this something that is going to be lasting or continuing, even though the patient has theoretically recovered from the lung part and no longer shedding the virus? They've tested the patient, has antibodies, and so on. And if that's the case, it's something we've not seen before.
Oh, great.
We also,
New surprises around every corner.
Yes, and there are going to be more. We've learned a lot. We everybody's heard about people losing their sense of smell and their sense of taste. Now we know that in some cases that's prolonged after you recover. We know there's some neurologic manifestations. We know there are some potential brain issues. We know that in patients with severe pulmonary problems, that can be long-lasting, and we don't know if it's lifelong as of this point because we're only dealing with this virus for 7 months, but the reality is it very well may be. And these are the things that need to be told so that people understand, especially those people who don't believe, well, people that believe the virus is not really dangerous, or it's a, and I hate to use the word a hoax because it's not, or it doesn't affect young people because it does. In fact, the new strain, the one that we're seeing now, is affecting younger people to a much greater extent. And that may be also because of their behavior, but the reality is we're now seeing younger and younger people. We just recently had a patient in their mid-30s who was terrible sick and one died. So it's not just the disease that kills older people.
You've seen people die in your hospital from this disease, from complications resulting from this disease.
Yes, Chad. I personally not been at the bedside, but yes, we have lost patients in our system, in our facilities, who have had the problems from the disease that caused them to die, typically respiratory failure. In some cases, they may have other things like heart disease and they died from their heart and so on. But it was all as a result of the disease.
I think that's an important distinction that some people aren't making, because you hear people say, well, the disease has, like, what is it, 80-20, right? It's like 80%, 90% are going to survive. And so therefore the death rate, like, because you hear like, this person died from a car accident, but they had COVID. So the government's saying, oh, well, but they're writing down they died from COVID so that they can inflate the numbers or whatever the conspiracy theory on that is.
No, that's not true.
Okay, so that's a question.
I'm sorry, Chad.
I'm not sorry that that's not true. I'm actually very happy that that's not true. But I'm curious about that because you don't hear people talking about the reason why that's not true. Because all the noise is people screaming, well, they just write COVID-19 on it just to inflate the numbers. And he died in a motorcycle. He was eaten by an alligator. So what is the deal with that? How does that actually work when you write cause of death and things like that?
All right. Cause of death on a death certificate is the responsibility of the physician who pronounces the patient dead. Those are state laws, not federal laws. All states license physicians independently. They all have pretty much the same laws. And as a physician, you are required to place the cause of death on the death certificate. Sometimes that's done by a pathologist because the cause of death is unknown and the patient winds up with an autopsy, and it winds up being the pathologist who did the autopsy that puts the cause of death. Most of the time that doesn't happen, and most of the time it's the treating physician of record that has been treating the patient, and by law you can't fudge that. That's not only a ethical and moral standard, it's obviously a legal standard. If you fudge that and you are caught, you will be fined, and I would suspect more than likely lose your license or possibly lose your license. One of my other hats is I, for many years, been on the Board of Medicine of state of Iowa, and that's an area that I have a fair knowledge in. And fudging a death certificate is pretty much a medical death sentence in terms of licensure for a physician. So no, okay. We're not lying.
Well, I mean, and that's the other thing. I mean, I assume that the physicians aren't lying. At least I hope not. I mean, it's an expensive lie. But I also think that the issue is that people aren't hearing enough about what it means to die from COVID-19. Because you don't really – it's not that you die from the disease, die from something that the disease does to you, right?
That is correct. One of the things that the disease does in those people that are dying – is it creates a war between the virus and your body's immune system. And literally the patients wind up terrible sick and die, those that die, because their immune system just goes haywire. And theoretically, there's so much inflammation that either don't oxygenate or their organs shut down from these chemicals that happen in inflammation. I don't want to get too technical with the biochemistry, but the body releases these chemicals from inflammation that are there to protect, but when they're an overwhelming amount, they actually wind up destroying the normal physiology of the body, and the body becomes overwhelmed, and literally the organs stop working.
Is that like Lyme disease? Because I believe that, like, with Lyme disease, it causes your body to go into hyperdrive and, like, throw everything, like, it's like it eats yourself from the inside out.
In a very small way, yes.
Boom! Oh, yeah! Did it! Nailed it!
It creates an abnormal and uneven stability. The word's homeostasis, the stability in your body of everything working together in consort, and it wrecks that. And if you already have some pre-existing issue, whether it be diabetes, which actually is a disease of inflammation, type 2 is, type 1's different, or you have cardiovascular disease, typically people that have one have the other, or you have pulmonary disease, asthma would be a risk factor, you already have a system that has an issue in terms of dealing with what it does. So it's already there, and typically humans have a tremendous ability to compensate even when there are issues going on chronically. This sort of tips it over the edge.
What about people that are like, because I also hear that there's people that are reasonably healthy, like they have a relatively good body and it's working and it's kicking ass and they're in their like late 30s or early 20s or whatever, and then they get it and then they're intubated and then they die. So how does that work with someone with a healthy body?
Well, we don't thoroughly understand that yet, but that goes back to that inflammation thing. So we know it overdrives our body's immune system and it overreacts. And in those people, that's what appears to be happening. And when there's inflammation, there are chemicals that are released to, theoretically, they're there to help you deal with an invader or a system that's not working. However, in the cases you're talking about, it appears that the inflammation system goes in like the triple overdrive, and it literally winds up destroying the things that it's there to protect.
Wow. So what's the thing that worries you the most about people getting it? Like, what's the thing that you're like, oh shit, you have this. Now I'm really worried about this part of that disease with that.
The thing I'm most worried about is the fact that we know that people can get it, not know they have it, and transmit it.
Okay.
And it's not necessarily the ones that are asymptomatic that are the problem. They don't know when they have it. They continue to function in society. They don't wear a mask. They don't socially distance. They go to wherever. And they infect people who are at risk. And yes, the vast majority of people are not going to get deathly sick. We know that. But the problem is that you don't know who is going to be deathly sick and who is going to be not sick. I mean, we can speculate. As I said, we talk about the pre-existing diseases. But we also know that there are people that are fine and healthy, at least as far as we can tell, and they get incredibly sick and they die. So that's why the idea of isolating the people that have the virus from everybody else and let them deal with the virus for about 14 to 21 days. And then they're over it. And then they're not infectious. And had we have done that at the very beginning, very, very aggressively, we more than likely will not have had, as of today, I think 134,000 deaths. There's speculation from the CDC and others that had we have done that, we would have prevented 30 to 40,000 people to this point from dying.
What about so we were talking earlier about herd immunity. Well, maybe we should just open everything up, let the disease run its course with everybody, and just kind of like deal with the fallout afterwards. Now, why is that fucking crazy?
Well, now I'm going to put my social science hat on. Sweden actually did that at the beginning. They decided, based upon their culture and their moral code, that they were not going to do anything and they were going to let it run its course and let the chips go where they may. After a few months, they wound up with such dire problems because those sick people wound up taking beds and staff and resources away from other things that are still happening. All the other diseases and all the other sicknesses are still there. And yet when you have something that's overwhelming like this, and those people tend to be sicker, they wind up utilizing the resources available. And in the United States, for example, we have vast resources in healthcare, but we've been pushed to the edge because our resources for healthcare are based upon what our normal operational day-to-day caring for patients with everything that affects humans with some stockpiles. And the problem with this is it became so overwhelming and there were so many sick people that all those stockpiles got used up very quickly. Now, this was predicted to happen. It's been predicted for years.
Okay, so what are we doing that's right now?
Not a whole lot.
Oh, damn, okay.
Every municipality, whether it be a community or a state, has been sort of left to their own devices. And so those that are not looking at it as a political football, but look at it as the reality and the science behind it, have done a little better job. If we look at the northeastern states and the New Jersey, New York, Connecticut compact, Massachusetts included, they were overwhelmed at the beginning, and they wound up, their governors wound up being very aggressive. They understood the science. They were able to isolate, and while they had overwhelming numbers, they had an incredible problem. They are, at least as of today, emerging better for what they did, although the economic impact was tremendous.
Sounds to me like what's going on is we've got an administration that didn't tighten up. We've got states that are kind of doing whatever they want, which is an issue because you need a unified response when it comes to a pandemic. Otherwise, you're just going to get little pockets of endemics, and then it's just like, who knows what's – it's like whack-a-mole. So what can we do to keep ourselves safe?
On an individual basis, that's actually fairly simple. We have really good data now that masks, both on the person who's sick and the person who's not sick, absolutely reduce the spread of the disease. It's irrefutable. The data is very clear. At the beginning, I mean, there was some criticism at the beginning because there was some suggestion on a national level that not everybody needed to wear a mask. Part of that had to do with we weren't sure about how the virus really was transmitted, and there was not enough masks of the surgical kind or the medical kind. We know now there, and as I said, there's really irrefutable data now that masking between two people, one who has it and one who doesn't, reduces the risk of the one who doesn't very significantly. Ideally, it would have been better at the beginning if we just all stayed home for 2 weeks. If everybody in this country had stayed home for 2 weeks and we shut everything down, which I know is unrealistic, the virus would not have taken a foothold because the host, which is humans, the virus needs humans to live in it. It can't live by itself. So if it doesn't have something to make it, give it metabolism and energy, which is our cells, it doesn't exist. So theoretically, if we said, okay, everybody in the United States, this is a big holiday. Nobody's going anywhere. Nobody's getting out of their houses. Everybody's staying home. If you're sick, go to the hospital. Other than that, don't leave. Which is kind of what they did in Wuhan. They wouldn't let people out of their buildings. Now, obviously, that's somewhat unrealistic. But they got control of it pretty quick. Because once you get past 2 to 3 weeks, because the virus can't live by itself, if everybody that has the virus doesn't interact with other people, and the virus winds up dying because of their immune system, which is what happens, guess what? No virus. Now, obviously, that's simplistic.
Right.
But
just what we love. We love the simplistic.
So that's what it is. Wear a mask. If you don't necessarily need to be out, I mean, I go out. Yes, we know outside, actually probably less communication in an outside environment unless you're cramped into sitting in a beach or God forbid, going to a bar. If you do that, be outside. Don't be in big groups. Small groups are 6 feet away with masks. If that, if you're 6 feet away with a mask on and the other person's 6 feet with a mask on, statistically, the chances are very slim that you're going to get the virus.
But not zero, which is important.
No, no.
Also noted.
No, it's not zero. And it, and there's a lot of reasons why it is zero. It could be zero only if everybody wore a ventilator mask and a helmet or something, but that obviously unrealistic.
So when you get a lot of people, again, this is the big issue now is the amount of people that seem to throw so many statistics at you that you just don't want to argue with them anymore. So you get people that are just like, well, the death rate's slowing, but the infection rate's rising. So clearly some numbers are wrong or something like that, that don't understand how statistic works. Where do you feel like we're at right now? I think because you can't just say where's America at, because that's incorrect, because it's not just the whole country. It's little pockets of things. And you also got to figure out who's in those areas and the population of those areas. So reading numbers is hard.
We're doing more testing, not enough, quite frankly, but we're doing more testing. So yes, if you do more testing, there are more people positive, partially because people are asymptomatic. That's one of the reasons why the experts have been always arguing that there's more people out there with the disease than we know about, because we don't test enough. Anyway, when you do that, the numbers go up. But you don't just capture asymptomatic people, you capture people that are symptomatic, which is why they went to get the test in the first place. So on what you have to look at is not the total number of people that are tested, is what the positivity rate is. If the positivity rate is less than 2%, like it has been in New York, that just means you're testing enough people because you're uncovering all those people that were asymptomatic. If the positivity rate all of a sudden starts going up, like it's done in Florida, Arizona, Georgia, and Texas, up to 23 to 24%, what that's telling you is that the percentage of people in the society that are affected is much greater than you anticipated. That means you don't have it under control. The death rate will fall after that, because when people are tested and they're sick, they're not necessarily in the ICU, they're not necessarily in respiratory failure, they're not necessarily in the ER. And the severity of the disease goes up incrementally after you become symptomatic. So the severity goes up later. So the way you look at that is, what's the number of patients tested? How many are positive? And what's happening in terms of your hospitalization rate? So if we look at what's going on now in Florida, Louisiana, Georgia, Texas, South Carolina, I believe there's a couple of other states. Not only is Arizona, the number of people tested going up, the positivity rate has gone up astronomically, but the hospitalization rate is off the charts. Well, that tells you you're not controlling the disease. So yes, it's the numbers are very telling, and they're dire at this time. The death rate is relatively small given the number of people that are sick. However, what it doesn't count is the severity of illness, people that are not dying, but what happens to them in terms of the severity of their disease, how it puts a strain on the healthcare system. We don't know about the long-term sequela. We know that some of it is not good. We know that people are winding up with probably long-term pulmonary problems. We know that people are going to wind up with long-term neurologic problems. And unfortunately, those numbers can't be uncoupled for years, because we won't know what it really means. We're dealing with it for 5 months. Other diseases we're dealing with for hundreds of years, so we have a handle on them.
You used a word earlier that I just want to check in on. You said sequela, and I don't know what that means.
The result of.
What? Is that a medical term, or is that just a word you know?
No, we use it very frequently in medicine, because we'll say somebody had a problem, like an embolism where a clot goes to the lung. That's the event, but that leads to other things, and that therefore is sequela.
And that's a huge term, I think, when regarding COVID and the misunderstanding of it, is sequela, because people just assume, oh, I got the COVID, boom, that's it. It's like, no, there's several things that are going on, and not to mention the shit that's already wrong with you. The sequela of that could result in death. Am I using the word right?
Yes, it could result in death, but it could also result in long-term chronic illness that you otherwise didn't have. Sometimes death's not the worst thing.
So then I guess what I'm gleaning from this sequela of information, or from the sequela of information, is that we should mask up, we should avoid human stuff if we can, and get tested if we need to.
I think that's probably the best advice. Mask, wash your hands. We know soap kills it.
I mean, the soap thing kills me. Because, like, you go to a supermarket and they're out of hand sanitizer and red beans, but you can get all the soap you want. And we know for a fact that soap is this thing's mortal enemy, which leads me to believe that people weren't washing their hands in the first place. You dirty fucking humans. I'm like, well, is this a thing? We're just not washing hands anymore? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to get – but this – the information I got has led to a sequela of emotions. And so now I feel like this is all coming out. Speaking of emotions, I don't know if you know how we do things here, but sometimes it runs a little hot, which leads us to ask some insane questions, which means it must be time for 2 minutes and 10 questions. Whip, whip, whip! No one is ready, and you certainly are not. Your record right now is 4 out of 10. Let's see how you do. Number one, why aren't injections reliable?
I have no idea.
Because they're all in vain. Number two, what happened when I looked up erectile dysfunction on the internet?
Your mind went limp?
Nothing came up. Number three, does an apple a day keep the doctor away?
Only if it hits him in the head.
Boom! Oh, 1 out of 10 so far. Hell yeah. We would have also accepted depends on your aim. Number four, why wouldn't the receptionist let the invisible man into the office?
Because she couldn't see him.
Boom! That's 2 out of 10. Oh my God, it's a record. Number five. What is the medical prognosis for dying from too many dogs?
Barkomania.
A roverdose. Number six, why was the duck sued for malpractice?
Because he crossed the road.
Because he was a quack. Number seven, how do you reduce the budget at a medical examiner's office?
Remove the corpse?
Cut coroners. Number eight, what do you call a fish with a medical degree?
A dockfish?
A sturgeon. Number nine, why do med students hate the kidney stone test?
No, I have no idea. No idea.
It's hard to pass. And number 10, what did 14th century doctors need to stay positive?
Leeches.
A sense of humors. But 2 out of 10, you are now on second place on the board. Impressive, but I feel like a doctor needs to have a good knowledge of puns in order to stay positive. Well, thank you, Dr. Zagorin, and all of your many degrees and expertise for giving us a little bit of insight into this colossal clusterfuck that we're in the middle of. Do you have any advice for the people out there as they go into their lives into this uncertainty?
Wash your hands, don't touch your face, wear a mask, socially distance, and stay out of crowds.
Hashtag sequela. Thank you for coming. We're going to get through this one day at a time, but for now, just stay the course, I think is what we're really trying to say, right?
Yes, with those certain caveats.
Caveats? Oh, fuck. That's another word I got to learn.
Whew, am I right? Special thanks to the Barracudas for your kick-ass song that you call Promises that is the pill that keeps me sane. Special thanks to Jepson's Malort and Hero Power, who are the poultices that I drink down. Altogether, really, a sequela of awesomeness that keeps us alive. And thank you to you for listening. Thank you to Dr. Zagorin for being there and throwing all that information at us. Find me on Facebook, find me on Instagram, find me on Twitter, blah, 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 blah. Email me at thebirdchat@gmail.com. And stay smart and listen to the doctors, because they just want to help you. A virus is not political. A virus doesn't give a fuck what you believe. It just wants to use your body to take it places. So don't be the Uber, be the driver. Wait, don't be the driver of the Uber either. Just be yourself and stay healthy. There, boom, advice. God, I'm thirsty.